This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking with Kenyan author and conservationist Dame Daphne Sheldrick. For over 25 years, from 1955 until 1976, she lived and worked alongside her late husband, David, who was the founder warden of Kenya's Tsavo National Park. And during that time, she raised and rehabilitated back into the wild many orphaned animals, including elephants, black rhinos, and zebra, among others. She's been working with wild animals for a long time. Really, she has a history with them goes back to the time that she was a girl growing up on her family's place in Kenya. She has received a number of honors for her work. She was decorated by the Queen in 1989 with an MBE. She was awarded an honorary doctorate in veterinary medicine and surgery by Glasgow University in June 2000. She was honored by the Kenyan government with the Order of the Burning Spear. And then, in the year 2006, Queen Elizabeth II appointed Dr. Sheldrick Dame Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. That's the first knighthood to be awarded in Kenya since that country became independent in 1963. She has authored an autobiography talking about her experiences in Africa. The title of her book is Love, Life, and Elephants, An African Love Story, and it's published in the United States by Farrah Straus and Giroux. And she's in the United States to talk about the book, and she's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning, talking by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The email, if you'd like to send in a question that way, is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Dr. Sheldrick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and how are you?
Oh, well, thank you.
Good. I don't know if I should I be calling you Dame Daphne. I'm not sure of the etiquette here.
Yes, Dame Daphne is correct.
Well, I'm very pleased that you could be with us. It's a very a moving story because obviously you write a great deal about your love for David, but also it's very moving because of the stories that you write about your contact with these animals, things that for many of us we only know from nature documentaries. Animals that you grew up living alongside from the time that you were little.
That's true, yes.
Maybe you could tell the story that you begin the book with, because it sounds like it was, on the one hand, rather harrowing, and also was the thing that perhaps prompted you to write this book.
Yes, well, this was a lesson that I had to learn the hard way, because I would never have believed that a wild elephant living in Tsavo National Park, where they've been very badly poached for many, many years, and where the elephants are not human-friendly at all, would actually approach a strayed human the way this elephant did. And I was actually looking for Eleanor, one of our orphaned elephants, and the stupid thing is that I didn't think it was Eleanor. It didn't actually look like her. But I was so convinced that no wild elephant would approach a human that I called the name Eleanor. It was the man who was with me, one of our donors, said, well, I did so want to meet Eleanor. I said, well, it didn't look like her, but we'll soon find out. I'll call her. And if it's Eleanor, she'll obviously come to me, and if it's not, she won't. Well, this elephant walked up to me, and my first words were, Eleanor, you've put on weight. She looked different. And then I thought, well, I don't know, my memory's failing me, and, you know, Eleanor's been a wild elephant for many years now, and maybe, you know, the ear notches change and the tusks change a bit, and it has to be her. Well, it actually wasn't her. It was her wild best friend, who subsequently gave the name Catherine. And if this hadn't happened to me, I would never have believed that that elephants could communicate such a sophisticated message to one another, that Eleanor had obviously passed on the message that I was a friend, because I used to see her often amongst the wild herds and call her. She'd come out of the wild herd, and Eleanor just noticed that humans like shaking hands. We never taught her this, but she'd put up this huge foot, and I could just get my my arms around it, and I'd hold her foot and talk to her, and we'd spend a little time together, and then she'd wander back into the wild herd. So this actually, you know, I thought it just had to be Eleanor, but it wasn't. And when she moved me aside using the strength she would for an elephant, and I fell against these jagged rocks and smashed the leg, I then knew that this was not Eleanor. And that, my first impression had been correct, in fact. And I thought I was done in then. I thought this wild elephant would come and kill me. So I turned onto my stomach, and she came up to me, and I could feel her trying to get her tusks beneath my body to lift me, because if an elephant wants to kill you, it can do so with a swipe of the trunk. They're immensely powerful animals. Or they kneel down and use the head. I knew she wouldn't kill me by sort of stepping on me or anything like that. And I shouted, no, 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 and then she looked at me, and, you know, when you're lying flat and this elephant's towering above you, tusks pointing down, it's pretty daunting. And again, I said, no, 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 and then she felt very carefully with her foot all over my break, bleeding profusely with blood and bone all over the place. And she was obviously very concerned, and again she tried to lift me, and I said no, no, no again, and then she wandered off. So that was a lesson I had to learn the hard way. There was no other way to learn that lesson, and it was the last lesson I had to learn about elephants.
Well, and so the point here is that you believe that somehow this elephant that you had raised from a baby, Eleanor, somehow managed to communicate to this elephant that had hurt you, that you were a friend, and that in fact that then at that point the elephant wanted to somehow try to help you. Didn't quite know how to do that, but wanted to help you.
It wanted to lift me, but I know that they can communicate now, because I've raised over 140 infant elephants now for many, many years. And I've known them, because at any age an elephant duplicates a human of the same age. They're not grown until they're 20, and they're with us for at least 10 years until they actually make their way back into the wild community in their own time. And it depends on how well an orphan can remember being a wild elephant itself as to when that happens. The ones that come to us that are 2 and older and can remember being a wild elephant and remember their elephant family clearly, will only stay with us until they're independent of milk, because elephants cannot live without milk for the first 3 years of life. And the ones that are orphaned as newborns, and I've raised 2 from the day they were born, those tend to stay longer with the human family that replaces the elephant family. And you have to try and replace what that little elephant would have enjoyed in a wild situation. And the most important thing to an elephant is the family. So we have a team of keepers that are with the infant elephants in our Nairobi nursery 24 hours a day, because a baby elephant would never be outside of the family. And all the family members would love and nurture it and care for it and touch it and be with it and protect it. You know, all baby elephants have lots of nannies that belong to the family that take care of the baby. And the mother's very relaxed about the baby. She just merely feeds it, because she's got so many little helpers to protect and look after it. And we've observed this now with some of our orphaned elephants who are having wild-born babies themselves and who've been raised through the nursery from early infancy. And we know that they can communicate sophisticated messages to one another, because some of our orphaned elephants that are now living wild have actually recruited wild orphans into their group. These are elephants that may be 6-7 years old. That's like a 6 or 7 year old human child. And they've been absorbed into the orphan family that are now living wild. And they will walk with the keepers, and they'll be totally friendly. You wouldn't know they weren't orphans. And I don't know if anyone's seen Born to be Wild, the IMAX film that features our orphans and the orangutans. Those elephants that came back from the wild to greet the newcomers that are coming from the nursery had amongst them 2 completely wild teenage elephants. And so we know that they can communicate sophisticated messages, because our orphans that are now friendly to the human family will be able to tell the others that that's absolutely fine. And some of our orphans now having wild-born babies, and Yetta had a baby at the beginning of this year, and she was raised from the age of just 1 month in the Nairobi nursery, and she came back with 50 other elephants, some of them wild friends. Some of them were ex-orphans that are now living wild, that were raised through the nursery themselves and then rehabilitated from the rehab stations in Tsavo. And she brought her baby back to show the human family. And that's the greatest accolade you can get from an elephant. When an elephant trusts you enough to bring the baby, a wild-born baby, back because she wants to share it with you and allows the keepers to actually go into the herd and handle a calf that's standing underneath the mother's stomach. That is something that blew our minds. And that happened this year, and it also happened with another orphan that had one at late last year in November, Malika.
Hmm.
And so I know that they can communicate sophisticated messages now, but the elephant that downed me, that was the lesson I had to learn the hard way.
Yeah. And the work, I think no one has had the kind of success that you and the other people that are now part of this nursery that's part of the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. No one has managed to do, I think, what you all have done. What do you think, and maybe it does in fact go back to your understanding of elephant society and elephant families, what do you think it is that's made it possible for you to have this kind of success?
Well, you know, I'm born in Kenya and grew up amongst wild animals. And when I was a child, wild animals were very, very prolific. They were everywhere. I had my first little orphaned antelope when I was about 3 or 4 years old, and given custody and care of this animal, which I absolutely loved, you know, unconditionally. And I married into the wildlife service. My brother was the first warden of the first national park in Kenya, which happens to be Nairobi National Park, where I now live. And through him, I met my husband. I've actually been married twice, once to Bill Woodley, who was a friend of my brother's. And through Bill, I eventually met David and married him. And lived in Tsavo. Tsavo National Park's a big place. It's 8,000 square miles. It's the size of Michigan State.
Hmm.
And it holds the largest population of elephants in Kenya. And so I had a chance for the many years that I lived there with my late husband to study the wild elephants. And I had a good understanding of animals anyway, because both my parents were very fine naturalists, and we spent all our holidays under canvas on safari. So, you know, that wasn't new to me, but there are all sorts of things that one has to learn, and we've learned those by raising the orphaned elephants, by knowing them so intimately that you can interpret the body language, by seeing them every single day until they're grown, bearing in mind that they're not grown until they're 20. And then even when they're living wild, they keep in touch with their human family. Because the family is very important to an elephant. And you know that saying, an elephant never forgets?
Mm.
Well, that's actually true. And so the orphans, although they're living totally normal wild lives, if they're in trouble, they come back to the rehabilitation stations where some of their family are busy raising another batch from the nursery into adulthood. And they come back with poisoned arrow wounds, with spear wounds, with snares around their legs, with all sorts of things that have happened to them. And the orphan animals actually mirror what's taking place in a wild situation amongst the wild community. And elephants are in deep, deep trouble these days. Climate change is having an impact on them. Rivers are drying up. Forests are being hacked out. Drought is becoming more frequent. The human population is expanding, cutting migration routes where the elephants have traditionally roamed for millions of years. Bearing in mind that elephants are born with a genetic memory. They're born programmed with what to eat, what not to eat, how to behave in a wild situation, and what their role in nature is. That's all instinct. We call it instinct, and that's instinctive.
Hmm.
So in that respect, they're better than us humans, and they can teach us humans a lot about nurturing and care. And, you know, they're such gentle, loving animals, such family-minded animals. They have the same sense of family, the same sense of death, and identical emotionally to human animals. And I've always looked upon humans as part of the animal kingdom as well. We belong to the animal cadre of life.
Let me introduce again the guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Dame Daphne Sheldrick. She is a Kenyan author, conservationist, expert in animal husbandry. She was born in and has lived in Kenya all her life. She has been involved in raising and reintegrating orphaned animals into the wild, including elephants and rhino and zebras and others. From 1955 until 1976, she was the co-warden of Kenya's Tsavo National Park, along with her husband, David, and she continues now. She lives now in Nairobi National Park, and is continuing to be involved in the same kind of work. She has written an autobiography of her life. It's titled Love, Life, and Elephants, an African love story. That is the title of the book. It's published here in the United States by Farrah Straus & Giroux. She's spending some time in the United States to talk about the book, and we're pleased that she could be with us and joining us by phone. And we have a number of callers, people who would like to talk with you, so why don't we do that? We'll start in, and we'll go first to someone in Champaign and our line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, good. So I wanted to make a comment about an elephant story. So on our third trip to sub-Saharan Africa, we had an encounter with an elephant, not in Tsavo, but just south of the Kenyan border in Tanzania in the game corridor between Kilimanjaro. And we were in a bush camp, on a bush lunch, and a cow with her young calf was in the area, and the calf was very curious about her, and he kept trying to get over towards us, and kept getting nearer and nearer, and she kept trying to keep him away, but finally she gave up and she charged the table, and in the melee, I tripped and fell, and she was on top of me, and as Dame Daphne said, she was trying to get her tusk underneath me. And I wouldn't be here making this call now if it weren't for a really quick-witted Maasai driver that we had. And he jumped into the Land Rover, and he charged the elephant with the horn blaring. The calf ran, and she made the right decision. She followed the calf and left me alone. So I thought it was a really remarkable experience, and I don't dream about it. I don't have any bad feelings about it. I understand fully that it was her backyard, and she was doing what she knew she had to do to protect her calf, so there's no problem there. But I would say one thing. Although elephants are absolutely wonderful animals, it's very easy to anthropomorphize them and to see them as human, and we have to remember that they're big, and they have their own agendas, and that they can be extremely dangerous animals. So I'll leave the elephant story at that. I will say to Dame Daphne that we spent some time in Tsavo West. It's a fabulous area. It's just an absolutely wonderful area, and we have absolutely loved our trips to Kenya. So I will now shut up, and I'll let her make some comments. Thank
All
you
right,
very,
very good. Well, thank you. Well, Dame Daphne, you may comment however you like.
First of all, one has to remember what humans have done to elephants, and elephants never forget, and that actually happens to be true. You don't know what that elephant has witnessed in her life. She might have witnessed the death of her mother. She might have witnessed the death of her whole family for ivory. Elephants have no reason to like humans. So with elephants, you reap what you sow. And I agree that if an elephant is wild, you have to be very careful of them because they have no reason to like humans, and that's understandable when you see what humans have done to them. But elephants, as I say, you reap what you sow, and our elephants that we've raised that love their human family will protect the human family. They walk with them in the bush every single day, and there's a change. When they leave the nursery, instead of following the human family, the keepers, when they're infants, suddenly there's a change and the keepers follow the elephants because the elephants are communicating with the other ones that are now living wild with infrasound, which carries over distance. They'll be making a plan to meet at a certain place out in the bush, and the keepers just follow. Now, if there's a buffalo or something dangerous in a bush, the orphaned elephants will know that it's there long before the humans. And the elephants will come around their human family to protect them, and also the young ones will be fearful. They'll come to the human family for protection as well. But two of the older bulls will be sent by the matriarch, and the matriarch's always the oldest cow in the group, to chase out the buffalo. And they will chase the buffalo out, not by sort of charging the buffalo as such, but by making a huge noise, bashing the bushes and trumpeting until the buffalo loses its nerve and leaves that thicket. But, you know, if elephants have been treated with, they're very, basically, very gentle, very fearful animals. And an elephant will be scared even of a frog or a dik-dik. And we see this every day amongst our orphans. They're not aggressive animals at all. And if they are aggressive, they've got a reason to be. And so, you know, one doesn't know what has happened in that life of an elephant. Because at any age, an elephant duplicates a human of the same age. They live a very long time. They're not grown until they're 20. And so, you know, it's understandable that some elephants are aggressive and dangerous. And I don't blame them either. When they come across family members with their face hacked out, the tusks taken, tails cut off, people hunting them when they leave the boundaries of protected areas, gunshots, poisoned arrows, you name it. And they have no reason to be friendly to humans. But if you do happen to get the friendship of an elephant, and it really trusts you the way our orphans do their human family, the greatest accolade you can get from an elephant is when it has its wild-born baby and brings the baby back to show the human family. That means it really, really trusts you, and that happens all the time with our orphans. I understand exactly how dangerous an elephant can be. That elephant that threw me, that I mistook for Eleanor, could have killed me with a swipe of the trunk and had every reason to probably do so. The only reason she didn't do that was because that she'd been told by Eleanor. And when I say anthropomorphize, when you talk about anthropomorphize, I think that you have to think of elephants in a human way. I've raised over 140 now, and I've watched them every single day, and I know their maids and I know their moods, and I know every nuance, all their body language and everything, and they're absolutely human emotionally. And this is the problem with humans. We haven't been able to actually understand the elephants because we can't anthropomorphize. You have to do that. When you're raising an elephant, you think in human terms because you're dealing with an animal that is emotionally human. And human in many other ways as well, with a far better memory than us and a convoluted brain that's bigger than ours and equally as convoluted, just as intelligent, on a different branch of life, of course. And so, you know, I always anthropomorphize when I have not just elephants but all animals. You have to understand the branch of life that they're on. They're different to us. But we are also part of the animal kingdom. We are animals. And we have to understand that. And nature repeats some of the many traits in animals, also in humans.
I want to thank the caller, and we have some others, and we'll just go on and talk with someone next in Urbana. And this is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. What are your thoughts on curbing the illegal ivory trade, or is it like drugs? It's just so profitable that it's able to corrupt a lot of people to sustain itself.
Exactly. I mean, it is greed and corruption, human greed and corruption, and of course the demand for ivory in the Far East, particularly in China, which has a burgeoning, wealthier population now, and ivory is symbolic there. It comes from the largest and strongest land mammal, and it's something beautiful to possess, and if you have an ivory hanko or seal, You've sort of made it. It's a bit like owning a Mercedes-Benz car and a Rolex watch. So there are more and more people in the Far East that can afford ivory now. And so the demand is there. So in order to save the elephants, first of all, that demand has to be stopped. And I think all ivory should be made illegal. And the countries that burn their ivory stockpiles and destroy them rather than sell them should be rewarded for doing so. And as long as there's a demand for ivory, there are going to be people in the third world where there's no welfare, where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of corruption. They're going to pick up their bows and arrows, poisoned arrows, and go and kill the elephants, and that's what they're doing today. And I just hope that the International Convention on Trade in Endangered Species, instead of facilitating the trade by selling Southern African stockpiles, will actually ban ivory as they did in 1989, and that's the only time that the poaching was reduced. And so it's been proven that selling the stockpiles hasn't helped the elephants at all. In fact, the poaching today is probably as bad as it has ever been in Africa. There's some countries like Cameroon that have lost almost all their elephants, about 600 slaughtered in a couple of days just the other day. Chad only has a few left. The forest elephants of Central Africa, very, very few left. And the African population of elephants has gone from 1.3 million to about 300,000 left today.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller and go on to another. And this is also Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I appreciated what you said about the anthropomorphizing. I think that the idea about not anthropomorphizing animals is somehow more scientific is not quite on the mark. We do have to understand that they have brains that are arranged the same ways that ours are, and that it's perfectly normal to assume that they're having the same emotions that we're having, even if it looks like they're having those emotions, even if we can't ask them, hey, how you feeling? The thing I really wanted to call about, though, was one comment you made about that they are born with an instinctive knowledge about what to eat and so forth. I don't know about elephants. I take your word for it. But I would have assumed that they learned that from their mother rather than had an instinctive knowledge of that. Isn't that the sort of thing that their family teaches them rather than that they would know automatically if their family didn't teach them?
Well, we've raised elephants. I've raised two from the day they were born. They were brought to me with the fetal membrane still all around them. They'd never suckled their mother. And those are very difficult to raise because they've got no immune system, not having had the first colostrum milk. So what we had to do was take blood from a healthy, bigger elephant, separate the plasma and inject that into an ear vein to get the immune system going. And we managed to raise these two elephants. And as I say, I've now raised over 140 infant African elephants, and they come to us just days old. As I say, those two brand new born, I can't teach them what to eat and what not to eat in the wild. I don't know enough about wild plants. And we don't ever feed our elephants anything that's not indigenously wild. They have their milk, and that's it. And sometimes a little bit of, I think, what you call alfalfa in the dry season. But we don't ever feed them what we call junk food, which is human food, like peanuts and apples and fruit and things like that, because that corrupts the elephants. But all our elephants instinctively know what plants to eat and what plants not to eat, and they're very selective about it. Now, nobody's been able to teach them. That's something that they know in the genetic memory. They also know when they meet an adult elephant how to behave, their subservient gestures that they do, and that we've observed that time and again with these little newborn ones that suddenly confronted by bigger elephants that have preceded them to the rehabilitation stations that are now living free and wild and come back to greet the babies, because all the elephants love the babies as long as that baby's behaving normally, and that's how it's raised. And our keepers, they don't even carry a twig. With elephants, you reap what you sow. And, you know, you've got to treat them with tender, loving care and kindness, and that's how they treat each other. And it's very interesting how elephants discipline wrongdoers amongst the group. And this happens even in the nursery amongst little 2-3-year-olds, bearing in mind that in any age an elephant duplicates a human of the same age. But the bigger females are always looking after the smaller ones and caring for them and, look, you know, they're there for them every inch of the way. And it's just so extraordinary. If one of the young boys is bullying a smaller one, because bullying is not tolerated in elephant society, you've got to have an age mate to play with, one of the same size. But it's very natural for little elephants to want to show dominance over another one. But if they pick a smaller one and that smaller one cries, immediately the bigger females will come, and the punishment that the wrongdoer gets is to be driven out of the herd. They will send him out to spend time out on his own, which for a fearful herd animal is a very severe punishment because they feel very vulnerable without the herd. And that's how they discipline each other. And we've seen it time and again with all our orphans and also the wild elephants as well.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Dame Daphne Sheldrick. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Lena Dunham, creator of the controversial and critically acclaimed HBO series Girls, about a group of 20-something women in New York City. Dunham plays Hannah, who has a sense of entitlement and is caught between childhood and adulthood.
She has to earn the admiration of the viewer in some way, and, you know, it's up for debate whether she ever does that.
Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning on the show, it's our monthly show on lawn and garden care. Sandy Mason will be here from U of I Extension. So anything you might be curious about or have issues with at growing the home landscape, we can talk about that. Then in the second hour, we will talk with Stephen Kotler. He is an award-winning science writer. He is one of the authors of a book that we discuss. The title of the book is Abundance, and the subtitle is The Future is Better Than You Think. And this really makes an argument that's rather different from that we often hear about environmental resource energy issues, that in fact it makes the argument that it is possible to meet and even exceed the basic needs of all of the people on the planet. So we'll bring you those ideas tomorrow. Again, we are here weekday mornings, Monday through Friday, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Dr. Dame Daphne Sheldrick. She, for over 25 years, she lived and worked alongside her husband, David, who was the founder warden of Kenya's Tsavo National Park. During that time, she raised and rehabilitated back to the wild many orphaned animals, among them elephants, rhinos, and zebra. She was awarded an MBE by the Queen in 1989, an honorary doctorate in veterinary medicine and surgery by Glasgow University in 2000, and in 2006. Queen Elizabeth II appointed Dr. Sheldrick Dame Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. That was the first knighthood to be awarded in Kenya since the country became independent in 1963. And she has authored a memoir, a biography, autobiography of her time in Africa from the time that she grew up there and through her marriage to David and her experiences up to the present. The title of her book is Love, Life, and Elephants, an African Love Story, published in the U.S. by Farrah Straus and Giroux, and she's in the U.S. now to talk about it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There are a lot of photographs. There are some wonderful photographs in the book of you and some of your children, and in fact, there's a picture of here of you with your grandchildren, and pictures of animals, and they're just really remarkable. I guess I'm the one particularly I'm kind of struck by is there's a picture here of you, of David and your daughter Angela, and she's sitting on the back of a rhinoceros. It's just the most extraordinary thing to have that kind of experience with animals, and something that I just can't quite fathom. That this was Rufus the rhinoceros?
That was Rufus, yes.
Tell me about, can you tell me just about that particular picture or about Rufus?
Well, you know, rhinos, of course, are quite different to elephants. They're very ancient animals, been unchanged for 60 million years, but they're wonderful animals. They take a little more understanding than an elephant because they are on a completely different branch of life. And but you, again, with a rhino, you've got to be more careful because their means of defense is attack. So when you're raising an orphaned rhino, if it happens to be sleeping in a bush, you mustn't startle it, you know, because it will attack to protect itself. And that's where they get the ferocious sort of reputation that they have, because they will attack as a means of defense. But when you raise them, they are the most endearing animals, they really are, and there's nothing sweeter than a little baby rhino. And they're very strange animals in that they're very solitary, and, you know, they're very complicated, they're fiercely territorial, and they fight for rank and status, the bulls, and it's very complicated. The whole thing revolves around the dung piles and the urinals and chemistry and scent. But Rufus was a wonderful animal. He really, really was. And you could do anything with him. And with our orphaned rhinos, if you just scratch a rhino under the tummy, it collapses. It lies down with its legs up. They absolutely love. They're very, very sensuous animals, which is strange for one that's such a solitary animal. I'm talking now about black rhinos, not the white variety, which are more social. So we've got two animals two rhinos in the nursery at the moment, one called Solio, whose mother was poached from Solio Ranch, where one of my first rhinos still lives as a very, very old rhino. The rhino called Push Me in the autobiography is now living, and he's in his late 30s. So I think Push Me must be the oldest rhino on the planet, actually. Hmm. And because when we left Tsavo, we moved our two orphaned rhinos. We knew that they wouldn't last long in a wild situation there with the events as they were at that time, a lot of corruption, a lot of poaching, and there's a lot of money, of course, in rhino horn. But Rufus was a very gentle, wonderful rhino until he suddenly turned very aggressive against one of the keepers who'd been throwing stones at him. And from that day on, he wouldn't allow any African to come near him. And that's when we decided to move him. We didn't know much about relocating rhinos in those days. I think Rufus must have been the first orphaned rhino ever to have been raised. And we made a mistake, and he was attacked by lions and wounded and would have been killed by another rhino anyway. It's very complicated, the reintegration process. For rhinos. So in that respect, they're quite different to elephants. They're easy to rear, not complicated, the milk formula or anything like that, just full cream milk, humanized baby formula, but they're very, very complicated to rehabilitate back into a wild situation. And that involves walking the rhino around the wild dung piles and urinals for 3 years until its scent is actually accepted as belonging in the area by the resident wild ones.
Yeah. I have some other callers here, folks. I think I would like to have the opportunity to talk with you, so we'll do that. And they're both in Champaign, and the first is line number two. Hello. So, caller there. Line. Yes. Yes, go ahead.
Hello, yes. I just have a couple of questions. One comment, too, about the rhinos. I've had the opportunity to scratch rhinos on their belly, and it's amazing how they flop over and lift their leg up like a dog, but... Anyway, my question is regarding the poaching and all. Do you think, what are some measures that the preserves can take to try to protect these rhinos? And do you think that they should be more aggressive with doing things like cutting the rhino's horns off so that the poachers have no incentive to poach the rhinos?
Well, I don't think that works because, if the rhinos are 60 million years unchanged, so if in 60 million years evolution has not removed the horn, it means that rhino needs its horn. And you would have to cut the horns off all the rhinos, and the horn is just a fingernail, in fact. You know, if the Far Eastern people chewed their fingernails, they'd be getting exactly the same substance. But a rhino without a horn is emasculated. It has no means of defense against other rhinos. And the horn grows again, like a fingernail. And when the price that it is, sort of five times the price of gold or whatever it is, I mean, I'm not familiar with these figures. When there's so much money in it, it's very, very difficult if there's corruption in impoverished places, and of course there is. There's no welfare in Africa, and one has to try and change the mindset of the Far Eastern people. And I've suggested that since they have such symbolic view of anything rhino, how about the sort of dung and the urine? That might be medicinal too. If they think the horn is medicinal, the dung and the urine of a rhino is probably even more so. And so I think we should try marketing that, and that would mean that the rhino stays alive. They have communal dung piles, and you just collect the dung and the urine and from captive rhinos, if you've got some in zoos and so on, make a fortune out of them.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to line number one. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a quick comment and then a question. The comment is that I really, you know, I think of people who go to, like, sacred texts for inspiration, but I really think that these animals that you're protecting, like the elephant and the rhino and tigers and lions, they're all, to me, they speak a lot louder than any sacred texts, and I'm really surprised more people don't see that. But my question is, and I'll ask and then hang up and listen to your answer on the radio. I was just wondering, do we know very much about what the balance between humans and elephants were back before industrialized Westerners came into Africa? I mean, did they kind of coexist, or were they always in contention with each other, or what was going on there? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
A lot depends on what sort of humans you're talking about. I mean, elephants and agriculture, of course, don't go together. An elephant can demolish a man's livelihood in an afternoon. But a lot of the tribes in Africa, in Kenya, for instance, there are 47 different tribes. And a lot of those are pastoral people that have traditionally coexisted with wildlife. They've had no reason to actually kill them. Some of those tribes have traditional affiliations with animals like elephants. Like the Maasai have an affiliation with lions, and to prove that you're a man, you go and try and spear a lion. And the Walyungulu tribe, you try and kill a big elephant. But you'd only kill a bull. You wouldn't touch a cow or a calf. And so, you know, the tribes coexisted peacefully with all wildlife in those days. They, of course, probably the ones that were carnivorous killed what they wanted to eat if they could, but most of the pastoral people have a very deep affiliation with wild animals in the old days, and you know, traditionally the Maasai held sway in a place like Kenya. They were the rulers, in fact, and they came down from the north and occupied most of the tribal areas, and they kept their cattle, and traditionally they would not kill wild animals, only lions, to prove their bravery. And so the animals proliferated and everything was okay. But, of course, when the white man came along with guns and things like that, things changed, didn't it?
I guess I thought that there not a point where the efforts to try to protect the elephants were successful enough so that they were, in some places at least, the numbers of elephants were actually a problem?
Well, if you put elephants in a small, confined area, yes, they can be a problem because, you know, they need a lot of food. And if the area is not big enough, traditionally elephants cross by international boundaries. Even the Save National Park, that's the size of Michigan State, they still move across the boundaries to meet elephants elsewhere. And 100 miles for an elephant is just a little stroll. And this is the problem. They need a lot of space. And if they're confined in a small area, they can do a lot of damage to the vegetation, but it's not permanent damage because they've planted another generation of trees in their dung. But you would lose probably all the elephants in a die-off once they've overtaken their food resource. But nature protects the plant kingdom, and the plants spring up again, as they have in Tsavo. You know, the elephants demolished the camifera woodlands in a lot of places, but they planted another generation of trees in their dung. The elephants took a natural die-off where nature targets the sick, the weak, and the maimed, and mainly amongst the females to reduce the breeding. Because if you cull elephants artificially by taking out entire families, the breeding rate goes up. All the age groups are intact and the families that remain, and they try and replace their numbers. And so there is no better way of actually bringing an elephant into line with its habitat than allowing nature to do the job for you. It's a lot cheaper anyway, and it's much more successful.
You know, I mentioned that there are a lot of wonderful photographs of you over time here with animals, and I'm just looking at a picture from just last year, I think, of you and an elephant named Wendy. And you're hugging the elephant. You look like you have your arms kind of wrapped around the elephant's trunk, and that your head, it looks like almost like your head is resting against the head of the elephant. And I just wonder, what is that like? What is that experience like to hug an elephant?
You know, that particular elephant, Wendy, I raised from the day she was born. I mean, she's like a child to me. She's now living wild, a perfectly natural wild life. A lot of people thought that this elephant that had never known an elephant mother would not be able to assimilate into the wild community successfully. But Wendy's a very, very successful little mini matriarch of the main wild orphaned herd now that's living totally wild. She's not the senior matriarch of that group because the older cow called Yatta, who's now just had a wild-born baby and brought it back to show the human family, she's the matriarch of that group. But little sub-matriarchs lead splinter groups back and under the directions of the main matriarch. And Wendy will turn up often and take one of the keeper-dependent youngsters out for a trial night out. And off they go for a night out, and sometimes the one that's having a night out gets a bit nervous, and then the main matriarch will detail a couple of the bulls to escort it back and hand it back to the keepers, and it goes back into the stockades for the night. Because in the nursery, the keepers actually sleep with the elephants at night. They're never on their own. But when they go to the rehabilitation stations, they're in a big stockade at night. We have to protect them from the lions until they're big enough to look after themselves. And we've got 69 of our elephants now living wild, and one of those is Wendy. And any one of her keepers can go and hug her like that. In fact, probably anyone could. She loves people. But they're clever enough to be able to discern between good people and bad people. No sort of poacher would be able to do that because the other elephants that she's with, some of which are wild, certainly wouldn't allow that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they get taught by the wild elephants who to trust and who not to trust. And they actually communicate to the wild elephants that, listen, these guys are different. These are our friends. And they have wild recruits in the ex-orphaned herd they've just picked up. These are young teenagers, maybe 10, 6, 7, 8, 9. Young elephants that have lost their elephant family, that are on their own, that have been absorbed into the ex-orphan group. And these ex-orphans are just as tame as the orphans themselves. It's quite astonishing. And I think anyone that's seen Born to be Wild, the IMAX film, where the ex-orphans come back to greet the new arrivals at our rehabilitation station in northern Savo, amongst those so-called orphans are wild elephants. And you wouldn't know they weren't orphans. They walk with the keepers, and even some of the adult bulls that come and drink at the stockades are so trusting now of the elephant keepers that they will actually walk with the orphans and the men. Hmm.
So we're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I do believe that your oldest daughter is involved in the same kind of work.
My oldest daughter was involved in the same kind of work, and now my youngest daughter actually runs the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. Elder daughter married a Frenchman. She now lives in France, but she's actually with me here in New York at the moment. Still very involved with all the elephants. I mean, she was my right hand. There's 9 years between my two girls. But the younger one now is David's daughter. Because I had two husbands. Jill is the daughter of Bill Woodley, my first husband, and Angela, who now runs the David Sheldrick Trust, is David's daughter, and so like him in many ways.
And some of your grandchildren, do you think, will carry on the tradition?
Yes. You know, I have two grandsons, Angela's two boys. They already think they run the trust. I mean, they've got a gift with wild animals, especially Taru, the elder one. And at home now, we've got a little orphaned Thompson's gazelle, which Taru can carry around like a baby. And this little gazelle is absolutely sweet. It spends part of its time in the house and part of the time out in the bush. And if it feels threatened in the bush, it comes back into the house. It's a little animal of two worlds. And its best friend's a little hyrax. And they sleep in Angela's office at night, and during the day, they're free to go out and in as they wish. And so, you know, if you can have that relationship with animals as you grow up, it turns you into a person that loves nature and animals. And I know that my two grandsons will definitely carry on the tradition. They've got it in their blood.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable family story here that you tell in much more detail than we have sketched out here this morning. But to have that kind of experience that you and your kids and now your grandchildren have had, to be able to know these animals and live with them in the wild, essentially in the wild, is something that I think is just really remarkable. It's not an experience that very many people get to have.
Now, I feel very privileged to just have been in the right place at the right time and to have been able to live this life. I know how blessed I've been and how enriched I've been by being able to be very close to a natural situation and nature. It's very good. It's balm for the soul, and you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing to be.
Yeah. Well, folks who are listening, if they would like to read more of this story, of the story of our guest's life, Daphne Sheldrick, the book is out now, and it's published in the United States by Farrar Straus Giroux. It's titled Love, Life, and Elephants, an African love story by our guest. She's Kenyan author, conservationist, expert in animal husbandry, particularly the raising and reintegrating of orphaned elephants into the wild, but she's also done this with other animals as well. She was, from 1955 until 1976, the co-warden of Kenya's Tsavo National Park with her husband, David Sheldrick. And you can, again, read all about it in the book. She's here now spending some time in the United States to tell the story. And Dame Daphne, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome.